Hello, everyone. It's wonderful to be here today, all the way from California. It's my first time to British Columbia, and I'm just overwhelmed by the kindness of all of you and just being here with all these cannabis heroes and people that I just really look up to and have really mentored me and helped me in my journey. So we'll go ahead and get started on this panel. I'll just go ahead and introduce Charles Holmes, and he is the co-founder of Hempco, Canada Superfoods. Charles has been pioneering the hemp seed food industry for 15 years, and his incredible work has resulted in the vertically integrated Hempco, along with several innovative processing and product firsts, such as hemp protein powder, hemp protein concentrate, and the newly launched Planet Hemp retail line of gourmet hemp food products. Charles teaches and speaks on health and wellness, and he and his wife and family are working to take Hempco and now Planet Hemp global. So this is Charles Holmes, co-founder of Hempco. So I think this is a great place to start in our panel today, grounding ourselves in Canada. And I feel just so very proud to be part of the North American hemp industry and the movement of us all working together collaboratively to bring industrial hemp as a stronger force in North America and spreading out globally. So I'll go ahead and actually sit down here. So I'm going to go ahead and start with a question for Charles. Charles, from the side of a hemp food processor, what have been the major accomplishments in aiding the development of hemp seed-based foods? Also, what are some of the most important things that we as an industry need to change in order to advance hemp as a food and take hemp seed-based foods mainstream?
Thank you, Anna. Hello, everyone. I'm honored to be here, and thank you for the Cannabis Hemp Conference. All the people put this all together. Thank you so much. With regards to hemp seed foods, there's pretty much four things you can do to them to help process them into a food that you find on the shelf. One is seed cleaning. Hemp is about the size of a grain of wheat, so it's not the easiest thing to clean, so it's an important step. Second step is most people will take an oil seed like flax or hemp or chia seeds and press them for oil. And that, of course, is can be done in several different ways, but it's pretty common. The next thing is you take what's left over from pressing the oil and you grind it with mills and you separate it with screens and things and make protein powders. And the last is hemp seed hulling, or removing the shells off those little seeds. Now, the hemp seed is very unique because it has this big, thick outer shell, like a tortoise shell, and has a very soft meat, so it makes it very difficult to work with when you're hulling. So, as Andrea smiled here, yeah, we've been... And, 15 years, there was no equipment you can buy off the shelf to do this. So it was a big R&D project for the last 15 years trying to figure out how to separate that shell off the meat. And we're still learning things every day. So when you ever see little shells in your bag of hemp nut, you know what? That's the frustration we have. And we're doing our best to make it happen. So in my opinion, the most important technologies really haven't been finished yet. I mean, we're talking about protein concentrates to keep the nutrition active and available to us as humans. There's still a lot of work to do there, especially into the meatless categories and non-dairy categories to make it more mainstream. That's where I see we're going to see the best work happen yet.
Thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and bring this on over to Joy Beckerman, back to our U.S. Ambassador for Hemp here. We already had a great introduction about Joy, that she's just been involved in industrial hemp all over the U.S. for a quarter of a century, and she's just really been such a champion for Hempcrete and hemp technologies, working with them. So I'm going to go ahead and just ask Joy to please give us a brief overview of the current legal status of industrial hemp in the U.S. What are some of the exciting highlights, projects underway? Give us some examples of what you're doing in Washington State.
Well, it's, you know, I'll give you a quick overview just first in general what's happening with the states. As you know, I said before, we have 50 of them, and when things don't happen federally, they happen one at a time. So we have 28 states that have legalized industrial hemp, but only 8 that have legalized industrial hemp. Washington is one of them, under Section 7606 of the Federal Farm Bill. So something that happened historically in the U.S., it was signed into law in February of 2014, was an amendment within our Agricultural Act, which we call the Farm Bill for short, called the Legitimacy of Industrial Hemp Research. And a lot of folks get upset when they hear research because, especially as someone who's been involved with it for a long time, we don't need to do any more research. We know hemp is fabulous. However, this particular research defines something called an agricultural pilot program, and in that agricultural pilot program, research is defined as studying the growth, cultivation, and marketing of industrial hemp. And we have successfully interpreted that word marketing as commercialization of the hemp that is grown under these research programs. It also, for the first time in U.S. history, defined industrial hemp and distinguished it from marijuana. We had never had that distinguishment before. And so 7606 is a very big deal. Now, of the 28 states that have legalized, only 8, as I mentioned, have legalized under these protections. The other forms of legalization have come in the form of what I like to call Wild West, and it can be very exciting, and that's Colorado that said, we don't care about your Section 7606, we're just going to legalize industrial hemp and do our own thing, and they're doing amazing things in Colorado to push the industry forward. Then there are states that legalized not nearly as effectively as the Wild West, and they didn't do anything with regard to 7606, so they've technically legalized industrial hemp, but they can't get seeds, they haven't funded their State Department of Agriculture, so there's nothing happening in those states, or there are sort of rogue things happening in those states, which I would say is as interesting as it is, and certainly the permaculturist hippie in me thinks that's all groovy and all, but we do need to successfully steward and shape this industry so we don't have failed crops, so that we can get people to invest in it in our country. Now, the other thing with these different states are taking advantage of various infrastructures within them, and most of them, the legal states for marijuana, have an infrastructure for extraction. So some of us who did legalize under Section 7606 still have in our own state law that we can't collect plant material for extraction for cannabinoids, phytocannabinoids, and Washington is one such state, whereas we're next door to Oregon that is fully allowed for its legalized hemp to collect the plant material and extract for cannabinoids. So we kind of have these 4 categories of states for legalization. The Wild West, that we did it so bad and didn't fund our Department of Ag that we can't actually plant seeds, and then the 7606 states, those that allow for plant material collection and cannabinoid extraction, and those that don't. But we need to build infrastructure, whether for fiber and whether for seeds, if we're going to be moving forward in the same way that that Canada has. Last but not least, with regard to what's going on, and we, by the way, just passed our hemp law, as I'd mentioned before, we're in our rulemaking process now in Washington, so we haven't even finished the applications to issue licenses for the 2017 growing season. Last piece on a federal level is that this interesting thing called the Consolidated Appropriations Act. We can't pass a budget, and we haven't passed one on a federal level in 14 years in America, but every year, so that the government doesn't shut down, they do in a Consolidated Appropriations Act. And interestingly enough, there was a section that went through, we can thank Kentucky for this, called Section 763 this year, which says that no federal funds for any federal agencies can be used in contravention of Section 7606, or, and this is the historical part, or to prohibit the cultivation, transportation, processing, or sale of hemp that is grown in compliance with Section 7606 within or outside of the state that it's grown. So this is a very big deal. Our federal legislators, our heroes, are protecting us any way that they can. And in this case, they're doing it through a budget. And so this is allowing 7606 states, especially those who are extracting for cannabinoid, phytocannabinoids, then to process and move that compliant hemp across state lines. Legal issues with regard to resins and cannabinoids and moving it across state lines, but our heroes are trying. So we're making great progress there, but we're making it under a research bill.
Thank you, Joy. It's very exciting times in the U.S. with our farm bill that has brought in these great pilot programs all over the country, finally getting industrial hemp back in the ground and some marketing research and development, as Joy was speaking on. Now I get to introduce Andrea Herman, who has been a big part of my hemp journey. She welcomed me to her farm. I stayed with her, got to go to the hemp fields. And what I really admire about Andrea is her work with students, teaching the first course dedicated to industrial hemp at Oregon State University eCampus. She also has championed iHemp Radio, which is a great opportunity to just learn and download those archives, iHemp Radio. So just working on these various projects over the years. So just going off what Joy is speaking on, Andrea, can you share with us your involvement in the U.S. with state departments of agriculture in these various states doing these pilot programs, these variety trials? Describe your experiences having worked with the DEA on permitting these projects. Tell us how you've been dealing with the border protection on clearing hemp genetics into the U.S. and why it is important to be working with these agencies to move forward.
Well, thankfully, coming from the Manitoba perspective, we've always had champions at our customs border protection because of a lot of hemp foods have been cleared through that particular port. So they're already familiar with what hemp is. So number one, we had some internal champions at the Customs Border Patrol who were keen on hemp already. Talking about with the DEA, I remember setting up a nonviolent protest across from the DEA's office in Missouri back in 2002, I'd have to look back, but this is when we were battling with the DEA in the U.S. So going from that point to then having the officers come down to our pilot project in North Dakota, and actually at the end of the day, if I would have bought the gentleman a beer. Of course, I could not, but they were really there to help facilitate what we had going on, but their hands were also tied because they have this wording, which now has kind of it's changing every day, of course. They had the wording that there wasn't really a word for hemp. So I actually got import permits for marijuana. That's what it came on the import permit. But one thing, they were really open to actually helping facilitate this because they knew that now there was federal legislation, as Joy spoke about, that mandated them to technically do so. And then the customs agents actually came on board also. So last year, I had the honor of clearing the first planting seed into North Dakota after 70 years of prohibition. And I physically drove the seed down in my personal vehicle. So I had to get my vehicle all registered. They knew I was coming. It was all very planned. And really, I was at Customs Border Patrol for no longer than 20 minutes clearing the seed. She spent more time, thankfully, Laura, thank you, telling me how grand she thought hemp was, and she can't wait to grow it on her own farm. And then when they told me I was free to go, I turned the car on. I had to turn the car off because I started crying, and she came over to console me. And now when I go through that border crossing, they really want to pull me in so they can get an update about what's going on in the U.S., which is very interesting. And they always give me a joke about what kind of hemp I have in the car. And I say, you pretty much be left with a car at the end of the day. So working with them has been really strategic. Also working with the state ag departments is one of the things Joy had stated, is that within lots of these states, they have not carved out the funding to actually have the state ag departments facilitate the work that's got to come on. And where do they get the money to now have somebody sit at basically a desk full time to answer the questions coming in about industrial hemp? How do they get the advice that they really need to understand? And John's going to talk about the genetic aspects, but we're not protected in the U.S. also. So the people providing the genetics from here, how do we work that language within the state ag department or the producer cooperators or the university projects to make sure that variety are protected and that people understand how we function here as a pedigreed seed system and internationally. And in facilitation of that, you start to see the DEA acting quicker. You start seeing, here in Canada, we have our own issues. It can be 60 days plus before we're getting some of our hemp license to get exports. So things are really important as it's timing lines. So we can't put our application in to export out of Canada when you're talking about wanting to plant in May. You surely should have that application in like January so that you can actually get the seed there. So part of the problem is, people are saying, oh, the DEA's holding up shipments. Well, there's paperwork. You don't fill out the paperwork, it can't move through the system. So having the paperwork, and also, that adds the legitimacy that we need. So now we know viable planting seed is clearing through the border. We're getting it through, and now we can change the regulations on how we're moving this plant material. And for instance, even if we built a fiber processing facility in the U.S., right now, because of the way the Customs Border Patrol, we can't move the bales that we have in Canada into the U.S. yet, unless it's under research project. So how do we change some of those things also when we can move other types of straw material from Canada to the U.S. for processing? And lots of those products may come back to Canada or stay in the U.S. Also do that for things like our bales that we have here. So increasing the farm gate.
Thank you. And this really shows how there's just so much work and opportunity for people to help others navigate all this bureaucracy and this system of how to successfully move forward and plan these type of projects. But I'm excited to introduce John Widmar. He's the Chief Operating Officer and Chief Technology Officer of NGK Biologics and Nutriponics Canada Corp. He holds his PhD in botany from the University of British Columbia. NGK Biologics is a MMPR applicant here in Canada. And John has worked on agricultural research for over 20 years. He was a senior scientist on the genomics team lead at Alberta Innovates Technology Futures, where his work focused on the improvement, evaluation, and breeding of both cannabis sativa for food, fiber, and barley. So my question for you, John, as a leading scientist in cannabis genetics, please share insight into your work up to date and the current events in genetic profiling. What's happening now with cannabis genetic profiling, and what is missing from current research, and what are some of the exciting avenues that could be explored in this sector in the future?
Okay. Thank you for that great introduction. I'm just going to start off with a little bit of background. In 2003, I had the opportunity to start working on hemp, industrial hemp, as we were not able to work on cannabis or medicinal marijuana at that point. And we were looking at specifically what are the genes involved in fiber production. Now, what's really cool about industrial hemp is that it produces two different fiber types, bast fibers. And anybody wearing any hemp clothing out there? Okay, there's one. Lasts a very long time, but it's also due to those long, great fibers, which, if we start looking at trees, are not present in trees. And so it's actually a very novel fiber form. And then you have the core fiber, which you can make really great building material. So I got basically tasked with starting to look at the genes involved in those pathways. Somewhat successful, had a lot of fun. Not very much uptake from industry at that time. So I started moving to food, started working on food hemp, and a lot of the tools in genomics and genetics is basically used for improved breeding. So a lot of the strains out there, or cultivars in agriculture, we call them cultivars, need to have support to increase their efficiencies in the amount of seed production or fiber production or in other possible uses of the crop. So we've been lucky. Canada has gotten quite a bit of support in that area. The hemp draft genome was actually produced a couple of years ago by a colleague of mine, John Page, also now currently at UBC. And what that allows is that a lot of the genes or the gene entities that are present within the plant are now known. The problem is they're just letters, and those letters can encode genes, which then give a specific phenotype in the plant. But currently, we have a lot of genes, and how they interact in the plant to make cannabis a great plant is unknown. And that's where the next phase of research needs to be done. Also, there's another project in Europe right now called MultiHemp, and they're actually resequencing, I think, over 200 different cultivars of industrial hemp. Now, what that allows is that you actually start getting little molecular markers present in certain cultivars and not present in other cultivars, and then you can actually use that in your directed breeding program. So that's my little roundup here.
Great.
No pun intended.
I think this segues nicely into a question I have for Andrea. How does the selection of a specific hemp cultivar, how does that impact downstream processes such as manufacturing products and the in-use markets? How does cultivar selection affect that?
Well, here we are based, the varieties that we can grow or the cultivars that we can grow are on a list of approved cultivars, so we can only grow certain ones, and they are really classified as distinct. So that's one of the things when you go to register your varieties here is that they are distinct. So thankfully within the breeding industry, providing those parental lines to help improve the seed yields, the fiber types per se, are really shared amongst the plant breeders. So that's really been able for us to develop the varieties that came from the Ukraine into the varieties that we have now. So if we look at the Canadian aspect, is that essentially what we brought in the first were like these dual cropping varieties. So the concept was that we were going to harvest the grain and the fiber. Fiber really first and grain secondary. Well, the grain industry really became the driving force. So from that, that also drove the breeding programs to reduce the height and stature of the crops and increase the grain yield. So for here particularly, since we have no fiber processing, what good is this for really to be growing a lot of fiber hemp when we have no processing or limited processing? And also looking at the facilitation of the growth and the agricultural equipment that you have. If you don't have the equipment to handle all of the fiber harvesting, why would you want to grow that when you've got the grain bins and the infrastructure to surround that? So that's another thing that we've seen. If you look at what's going on in Europe with really being principally fiber driven, the types of machineries that they're using are also different. The applications that they're using and the harvest timing, their crop rotation, rotation flow is much different. And as I said earlier, like trying to haul a bale over 100 miles becomes uneconomical. So that's also looking at what kind of infrastructure. So, you know, maybe hemp doesn't belong in cultivation everywhere for the same application, but it sure in the hell belongs in your belly, on your back, in your automobile, and in your home, and in most of the dollars that are out there. So it's really looking at what infrastructure you have. How do you develop that? It's like, okay, well, if you're not, I get lots of communities going, oh, you know, we want to farm hemp. All right, let's talk about what farming infrastructure you have. Oh, we have none. But you want to farm hemp. Can you tell me how much money it's going to cost? All right, well, let's talk about a bin. All right, let's talk about pouring a pad. Let's talk about a $300,000 piece of a farming equipment and all the infrastructure that goes there. So maybe we look first at what infrastructure you existingly have and how can we incorporate hemp into that, which then will maybe help drive that agricultural landscape around you. So looking at what we have and how we can incorporate hemp into it, and then maybe we can start focusing on some of the bigger pictures as part of the solution, and how do we get the jobs that are going to drive the money back into the community without having to come in and build massive infrastructure.
Thank you. We're about to start the Q&A, but I have one question I'm just really wanting to ask, opening up the panel. How do you approach the discussion with people when they ask about the difference of hemp seed oil and hemp oil, specifically people searching for like CBD or cannabidiol, and then the hemp seed oil, which is the omegas, essential fatty acids, and how are we working with language and industry to help clarify with people that are out there getting these products, what they're getting?
Charles, go. Do you want to talk from the hemp food business perspective? We can talk from the legal.
Sure. From the food side, it's pretty easy. We just say, you know, we're pressing the hemp seeds for oil, and that's what we serve up. There's nothing else added to it, whereas the hemp oil also has additives from concentrated CBD, so it's pretty simple from a food perspective.
From a legal perspective in America, and I know you were at Natural Products Expo West too, weren't you, with Hempco? So, and I was there with Hemp Production Services. Every other visitor at the booth was, oh, your hemp oil? Is that CBD? Was that at Hempco's booth as well? That confusion?
Often, yes. Yeah.
So, and that confusion is rampant. And so for the Hemp Industries Association, a couple of years ago in July, it was actually 2 years ago this month, they put out a meme that said, this is hemp oil. And it had a picture of hemp seeds and some beautiful green oil coming out of a decanter for actual oil. And then it said, this is not hemp oil. And it had syringes and tinctures and paste and things that look like medicine. And then it said, hemp oil is oil pressed from the hemp seed. Hemp extract, this hemp oil, is extracted from plant material, from the leaves and the flowers and the buds. Now, and then the Hemp Industries Association really wanted to toe that line, that we were going to keep calling hemp seed seed oil, hemp oil, and we wanted everyone to know the difference. Well, it's just too confusing. Now the hemp seed oil industry is at this point willing to say, we are hemp seed oil, people. We are hemp seed oil. And the hemp oil and all of that other confusion can come down to it. But it is a tremendous point of confusion, and it is going to take public education, and it's going to take the industries such as Canadian Hemp Trade Alliance, the Hemp Industries Association, and some phytocannabinoid professionals and the FDA and the American Herbal Products Society to really get involved in just educating the public, because hemp seeds are not a significant source of cannabinoids.
Thank you.
And I'll just add that. And part of that, in addition, is getting the proper HS codes and the shipping codes that we need that really define the product. And just coming off of multiple, you know, international speaking engagements and seeing what's going on, and I've been places where they're actually telling consumers that, you know, this CBD comes from the stock. Because they can get it into the country if they say it comes from the stock, because the stock's unregulated. And I don't know any real, like, CBD that's 100% coming from the stock. Please, somebody prove me wrong that there's a brand out there that 100% only gets from the stock and there's no leaf and flower material in there. So it's part of really making sure that when it comes to Customs Border Protection that we're fighting for those HS codes, and that is happening through our colleagues in Europe. So they're working on an HS coding system that then we'll be able to easily adopt. So that's other important factors.
Great. Does anyone have questions that they'd like to bring forward? We have a few minutes for Q&A.
Hi, my name is Steven Teed, and I'm here from the Adams Lake Indian Band, and I gotta say that's very informative, and it's very nice to see people working so hard for such a beautiful project and industry, really. Now I kind of forget my question.
Take a breath.
Oh, there it is.
Okay, so I just want to know, as a person living in BC and wanting to support everything you guys are doing, what is a way that I can actively start supporting hemp? I'm already communicating with my community and everything, but I want to go on a bigger scale, and I want to start, you know, growing hemp as in our community, and I just want to know what are some really easy ways to start getting people to even making a difference for you guys to make your jobs easier so we can live a better life. That's what I...
Buy hemp.
Ho.
You know, simply put, I mean, if you have interest in your community, you want to see their health improve, you have to go and educate them. You can bring people in from companies like ours and say, hey, we believe this food will help us with these issues. And once they start spending their dollars, it all starts to change, because our dollar is the most powerful vote we have.
I think also looking at what infrastructure we have, I mean, I know there's a certain, you know, especially coming from the First Nations perspective, if we talk about the building issues that we have with the substandard homes that are provided, and how do we take that portion? So one of the things that we've done with the Minister of Housing in Manitoba is we do have a hempcrete house that's been built as part of the Building in the North project. And how do we, you know, also not just give a home, but how do we educate the people that are going to be living in these homes to maybe potentially go out and build these homes? So that's part of that education factor coming in. You know, thankfully here, if we look at some of the First Nations, there is opportunity for funding to come forward, but looking at like building applications, or as I was saying, looking at what infrastructure you already have and how to incorporate a little bit of hemp into that. So if you got a home soap maker, for instance, right, get some hemp seed oil into that and start educating. And also if we look at, you know, like rates of diabetes, and how do we incorporate hemp foods into help the diets of what's going on? I mean, particularly on the First Nations, this is some of the things that has been brought forward to me about how we can incorporate to help the community, especially on a diet front, highly digestible proteins and things for inflammation coming from hemp seed oil outside of all the other medical benefits. Oh. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. I wonder if you could talk, I know there's a difference here between the Canadian and the American regulations, but the availability of trichomes from industrial hemp to be transferred into other stuff. So not the hemp parts to make hemp seed oil, but the actual use of the trichomes. So it's Canada I'm particularly interested in.
Okay, in Canada, actually, when we grow industrial hemp, there are only two parts that we can harvest. We can harvest the seed, and we can harvest the stems. Currently, we cannot harvest any other green material off the plant for isolation of any other compounds present within the plant. So currently, we are not able to do that. CHTA has been lobbying government to actually change those rules, and that way we can actually get three product streams or major project streams from industrial hemp.
And I think it's important to note that it is still, however, a widespread underground black market practice, illicit market practice here, that hemp farmers, in fact, unlawfully, they're farmers. They want to use all the biomass that they grow. It's ridiculous that they have to leave it on the field. And that's what, in Washington State, it's the same thing. We're only going to be allowed this first year, and except for another act of legislation, to process the seed and the stem. No, we're going to have to leave the plant material by law on the ground, just like the farmers in Canada has to do it. Having said that, of course, it's a widespread practice that they absolutely don't do that, and they collect plant material and they extract it and they get their biomass out there and it helps people. But it is unlawful in the state of Washington and in the country of Canada.
And just through the regulatory changes, as they talk about the fact that, well, you can get the research permits to do the research, so under industrial hemp. So our hands aren't completely tied, and we need that research to add legitimacy so that we can make the regulatory change. Now, maybe you're not going to be able to sell that research material on the market, but if you can prove its efficacy and its safety, it will help us when we talk about coming to Health Canada to make that change, and having more people apply for those types of research projects, do those research projects and bring forward and publish that work, adds legitimacy so for that change. So if it's something you're interested in doing, we can definitely help facilitate a research project.
And I could talk for an hour on it and would love to tell you more if you're interested.
Thank you. So that's the closing of our panel today. I want to thank you all for being here. And we just, in America, appreciate all the work that's been done in Canada and all the exchange of knowledge, and specifically the opportunity for anybody, no matter what field of study they're in or what they're doing. I feel like hemp is something that they could really integrate in one way or another. Any student studying at school, you know, educating their peers and their faculty about industrial hemp and the nutrition of hemp, and really making that bigger change, so that way we can just boost the acreage and just make it just keep growing. So thank you.
I want to say a special thank you to Anna for putting all the questions together with an incredible panel. This was really the mastermind panel of the conference. Thank you so much for taking time to come here from California, from Washington, from Alberta, and Andrea, where? From Manitoba. Manitoba, yes, it's incredible. So thank you so much for honoring us and coming all the way here. Thank you.
Thank you.